Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, everyone. This is Victoria from Rochdale, and you're listening to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, what is the best way to cook and eat a potato? I'm going to say hash browns. Okay, here comes the show. And remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dame Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer.
Hello!
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. And we are talking everything from...
Well, we're talking everything from Victoria, from Rochdale's question, what is the best way to cook and eat a potato? It's the old Ishan Akbar question, Dane, from episode
Ishan Akbar conundrum.
It's
come up again, which is fair enough. It's a staple part of the modern diet, slow-release carbohydrate, very starchy stuff. And by that token, I think... there is no right way to cook and eat a potato. I would say if you are one of the people in this world fortunate enough to get your hands on something that's edible, then you can devour that how you see fit. Me personally, I think that potato works the same way as dairy does. Different seasonalities and occasions will call for different types of preparation.
Yeah, that's a good
point. So a roast potato might be good for a weekend or for a roast, maybe not a midweek meal or for a lunchtime meal. Mash would be... ideal as well if maybe you have elderly members of the family joining you for dinner.
Fair point. I love those chips that are so crispy, you know, they're basically crisps.
Thrice cooked ones.
Yeah.
Like you get with steak.
There we go. But there you go, Victoria. There's some answers for you on potatoes. But suffice to say, on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dane?
Absolutely, no question is too big, too small, too starchy or too carby. And if you do enjoy the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify and you'll never miss an episode. Or you can subscribe to us on Acast, the world's biggest podcast network, where you can hear all of the very special questions being asked and answered by our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show is an Irish satirist, musician, podcaster, author and TV presenter. He is well known as one half of the Irish comedy hip-hop duo The Rubber Bandits, who wear plastic shopping bags as masks to civilized identities, and he has hosted his own podcast featuring interviews and coverage of major social issues, and has also published two collections of short stories and produced the BBC Three documentary series Blind Boy Undestroys the World. If you don't know by now, then you're not very good at clues and hints, but we welcome to the show Blind Boy.
What's the crack, Dan? How are you getting on, Howard?
Yeah, good, mate.
We're good, man. How are you? How's life?
I'm good. Am I not going to get asked a potato question?
We'd
be remiss of us for not. I mean,
get stuck in, mate. What
I thought Howard. I thought this was deliberately planned by you, Howard. It was initially kind of culturally insensitive, but it's just.
I love the fact that it wasn't.
It wasn't at all. No, do you know what? Listeners, just to let you know one thing. Getting these questions from you is definitely a ball ache of my life every week. So please keep sending them in. But they're picked quite randomly, Blind Boy.
You know? But I love that. I do enjoy the fact that like you brought on the Irish person and then you don't ask the potato question.
Which is more exclusionary. So the floor is Blind Boy. What do you think the best way is to cook and eat a potato?
Jesus, like you said, Dan, you can do anything with it. I mean, there is the issue with potatoes that, okay, they're full of carbs. Like, so whatever way you eat a potato, I don't think there's any real healthy.
Yeah. But then again,
chips are great. Chips are so good.
Like, they're so good.
With all due respect, you can't have a problem with chips. Like,
you really can't.
Everyone enjoys chips. Mm. And then mash. Mash is lovely. You can fuck up a mash.
How do you fuck up mash?
If you're using the wrong type of potato. I mean, that's the thing. Like, there's all different types of potato.
For different occasions, right? Yeah,
For different occasions.
One consistencies. Of them is, yeah, yeah. Go ahead, man. You educate us.
one of them's good for mashing, one of them's good for roast, and one of them's good for frying. So if you use a type of potato, I can't, like, Carr's Pink is one that we have in Ireland. If you use one of them and it's meant for chipping and you use that for mashing, you end up with something that's a little bit rubbery and not fluffy. So it's all about what you do with it. But yeah, the reason I piped up on the potato thing is, I'm sure there's tons of British listeners now who just love to hear the word potato in an Irish accent. And that's absolutely fine. And I understand that. But one thing I would like to say, because you don't, this is the beauty of podcasts. This is why podcasts are fantastic.
Yeah.
Because this is, like, you lads have an independent podcast, I get to say something that not a lot of British people get to hear, which is, if you're speaking to an Irish person in real life, just be careful around the laughing at the potato thing. Because most Irish people won't get offended by it. We won't, because we understand that when British people laugh at the word potato, that there's no malice intended. It's just a funny way to say the word. But in Ireland, in the 1840s, we had what's called the Great Potato Famine, which in Ireland we actually view as a colonial genocide, where our population went from 8 million people to 4 million people. 2 million of those died, and it was a direct result of English colonization, English policy towards food, exporting food, laws in Ireland that subjugated the native Irish, the penal laws. So just be careful. Yeah. When you're speaking to an Irish person, when you start hilariously laughing at how Irish people pronounce the word potato, that the context of that to an Irish person is very, very different, even if you don't intend it to be offensive.
That's very important to hear. It's probably time for a question, isn't it, mate, as the format of this show dictates?
Absolutely. We're on a great, great roll. Blind Boy is our very esteemed guest. We invite you to ask the first question. It can be any question you like, which we'd like to discuss for 15 minutes. Then Howard here would like to pose you a question, which we will also discuss for 15 minutes. And then, in a surprise twist of fate, I would also like to pose you a question to discuss. And then we'd like for you to tell our listeners about all of the great works you've done and where they could find out about more of your good work, such as your podcast, etc. How does that sound?
Cool.
Cool, man. The floor is yours to ask the first question.
So the first question, it's kind of broad. Cool. What does music mean to you?
Oh, lovely question, man. Lovely question. What inspired that question?
I fucking love music. I love music with all my heart. When I listen to music, it feels like my soul getting wanked by God.
I think that's a great way of putting it, man. That's a great way of putting it. And the thing is,
you've got to put that on a t-shirt, surely.
Not just on a t-shirt. That's the great thing about music, is that some people may perceive that as being something quite crude, but if you were to relay that melodically, most people would say, no, yeah, I totally relate to that.
Yeah.
I totally relate to that. So it's a really good question.
It's a powerful thing, isn't it? And you know, I think that you could, let's start with the negative bit first, because that's how I work. But like, do you ever meet those people who don't say they don't really like music?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, you're done with that person, right? Like, there can't be much of a future for me anyway. No offense.
Sociopaths. I think it's a sociopath. I mean, that to me is very telling of someone who may have somewhat psychopathic tendencies.
It's a bit odd. Sometimes I do respect the honesty of it though.
I think
like everyone listens to music until they're like 24. And then after 24, that's when people divide into people who actually like music and people who don't like it. And then I think like the mass market, do you know the way CDs are still for sale? Do you know the way you can go to Tesco and you can buy a CD and this still exists? Those are for people who don't like music. Those are for people who are like, I'm going to get a CD for the car because it's cold.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a clear distinction between people who hear music and listen to music.
Yes.
That, I think you're absolutely right. There are people who can passively take in what is being relayed on commercial radio stations and not question it.
Yeah.
And there are people who, like you said, yourself and people like myself, who see music as a form of escapism. It's an amazing tool for projection. It's an amazing coping mechanism.
Yes.
I find that it allows me to articulate emotions and, yes. and the centers that I wouldn't be able to do through conventional methods.
Yes.
And so by that token, if I am exposed to music that doesn't provide that for me, then it's not something I can enjoy. Whereas I think a lot of people aren't particularly discerning about the music they hear and they just kind of go along with it.
That's beautiful what you say there, Dean, when you're talking about how it helps you articulate emotions, because you think of, like, if you have a breakup or something, or if you're sad about something, words won't help you, but music will help you to understand the emotions that you're going through. Like, what I love about music is symmetrical vibrations of air that make you feel emotion.
Yeah.
So the way that we would look at a lovely painting, a pattern, the way that symmetrical patterns, when we see them, are like, wow, that looks nice. Something about this gives me a sense of balance. Hmm. Like, music is that. But with vibrations of air.
And what I think inspires these kinds of conversations, and why it's quite, you know, you get quite excited when you can talk about these things, is you can't quite explain it. That's my theory about music and art generally.
It's fully abstract.
Yeah, and there's times where you kind of start to put rules into it. Like for example, if I went through my kind of Spotify of recent times, like I've recently just rediscovered the Guns N' Roses song November Rain, which obviously...
Oh, what a beautiful song.
Obviously isn't a song. It's like a 10-minute fucking epic piece of...
Check out the solo. There's a solo piano version of that.
Oh, wow. Nice.
And it's actually more beautiful than the original.
Yeah. But it is a song, but it depends. But that's
you know what I mean? It's this incredible piece of music.
Good point there, because like I said, music really is abstract. And I think sometimes the efficacy of it is reduced when we compartmentalize music as an art form into compartmentalized ideas like songs. So it's like I said, it's a great piece of music. One of the problems, or how music's its benefits have probably been curtailed somewhat, is the fact that commercial interests have tried to put them down into, like, 3 minutes and 3 and 30 seconds, or now the average song is like 2 minutes and 40 seconds, whereby a song is only supposed to convey a very simple message without very much depth. Whereas, like I said, songs like November Rain, the song Hazard by, I think, Mark, is it Howard Mark who did the song Hazard?
Right, I have to double check that.
Because I have to get that right, because it's a guy that wrote Time After Time.
I know who you're talking about,
Richard Marx, Richard Marx wrote Hazard. Like, that song, again, or even, like, I remember I came across the song Frankie by Rod Stewart. And, you know, Rod Stewart isn't the type of person I would typically be listening to, but when I heard the level of depth that's in that song, I was just blown away, man. It's just such an amazing song.
The way mood takes you is fascinating, right? Like, I was listening to... I'm well into my soundtracks. So, like, I've got this... there's this Hans Zimmer Live in Prague album.
Yeah.
And it's fucking intense. So he goes through, like, everything from, like, Rain Man to Superman to Dark Knight to Interstellar, and then finishes with Inception. And it's all live and it sounds amazing. And then just at some point, I can't explain why, when I was listening to this earlier, I just really got in the mood for It's Tricky by Run DMC. And it completely...
Something about the melody reminded you of that, you know?
It's weird.
But, like, the thing is, too, like, I find myself listening to a lot of soundtrack stuff when I'm writing, we'll say.
Same here, yeah.
So I listen to Hans Zimmer, Ryuichi Sakamoto, I listen to Ennio Morricone, like, because just the soundscapes that they produce, they can allow me to feel emotion on a feeling level, but I'm not engaging with it really intellectually because there's no lyrics.
Yeah, it's and a powerful thing.
What I find really fascinating about music, and it's the one question I can never, ever answer, is you take something like November Rain, as you mentioned, beautiful chord progression, a beautiful melody from Axl Rose, but then you have these lyrics as well. Now, if you read the lyrics of November Rain, devoid of music, as a piece of poetry, it won't impact you the way the song does. And then if you just listen to the music with no singing on it, that music won't impact you the way the entire piece does. And the beauty of songwriting is that it takes the lyrics of poetry, and then it takes music, vibrations of air, and the lyric and the melody meet somewhere in the middle to form this new emotional meaning. Like, I love Bob Dylan, but I bought a lyrics book of Bob Dylan and read just his lyrics, and it doesn't hit. As poetry, it doesn't hit me in the heart the way it does when those lyrics are sung.
Well, he's got a very famous album called Blood on the Tracks, which if you...
Oh, one of my favourite albums.
And that's literally, if someone says to me, hey, I've just broken up with someone, I'm like...
There you go.
Probably go and listen to Blood on the Tracks, mate, would be my advice.
That is a lot of people. And that's one of those things throughout the years. Like men, as we know, we tend not to speak about mental health. We tend not to have a rich language around emotions. Yeah. Go and listen to Blood on the Tracks if you broke up with someone is one of the few little acceptable things that men say to other men.
But I find hip hop has such an interesting place to play in music now as well, because hip hop offers this kind of unique bit of your brain, I think, Dane. You know what I mean? Like you kind of, you're given a straight passage to a bit of your brain.
It's quite minimalist, but it really, hip hop is probably exemplifies what Blind Boy is saying about the fact that you can have lyrics or poetry that exists solely, and it can stir emotion, but not be as provocative. But when it is provided with a soundscape alongside it, then it can resonate in ways that people wouldn't imagine. And if you think about hip hop's real origins, it would have been from people like the Last Poets and like people like Scott Heron, who would talk about like E Pluribus Unum, and you know, having the drums alongside with that, building to a crescendo, makes that so much more a more poignant piece of poetry and social commentary as opposed to just being a song. Mm. By that token, Howard, I think you're right in terms of how hip hop is important. Like hip hop's cultural significance and its original soundscape is infinitely important, I think, for me in terms of identity and as well as being a tool of rationalizing my existence. Because, you know, through normal conventional means of trying to look back in history and contributions to art and literature, I'd be pressed to find a fair representation of the contribution of Black artists towards music and literature. But when you listen to something like hip hop, when you combine the samples plus the voices and references, then you're able to enjoy that on a number of levels, whereby, you know, it's contemporary music that has lent from previous artists who may have not been recognized at the time, you know, for their work, which are now not only provides me with the opportunity to enjoy and project and to identify with the themes in that song, but it also gives me a certain period of time travel whereby I can tell you for free, like I would have been somewhat versed, but I wouldn't have known about the works of James Brown or Rick James or, you know, just numbers of doo-wop musicians and people like Frankie Lyman were it not for hip hop. So, you know, that's what it means to me, is that it almost allows me to link with a collective consciousness of people who would have had very similar experiences to me. And even though the aesthetic and soundscape around the time that they would have been at the same age as me wasn't the same, I can definitely identify with all of the same periods and stuff like that as well. It's a
amazing way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think hip hop has been very useful in that respect. I think in where, you know, and we can both relate to this, Blind Boy, where, you know, imperialism has tried to reduce and ridicule small colloquial turn of phrases and idiomatic expressions within our communities, then we get re-empowered again because of things like hip hop that always exists. I think hip hop, for example, has been the tool of the powerless for them to strike back out against narratives from.
Do you agree with that, Blind Boy?
Yes. And like, I grew up listening to hip hop as a fucking child in Ireland. And hip hop's very popular in Ireland because, like, so we have in Ireland what's called Irish rebel tunes. And these are songs of Irish resistance, which are our music, our traditional folk music. And the themes and lyrics of our traditional folk music, it's near identical to hip hop. It's very similar. So we have a famous song called, there were British Army soldiers in Ireland around the 1920s. They were very, very brutal. They would have been the equivalent of the SS.
A lot of those loyalist paramilitary actually have lots of links to white supremacist groups, as we all know.
Oh, yeah, so, man, you trace that shit. Yeah. I would
say this, Blind Boy, like with the reduction of the Troubles rather than say the end of Troubles, when all of these decommissioned firearms and guns that all these paramilitary Northern Irish groups would have had, where do people think they went?
Well, a lot of them went down to the streets.
Exactly.
Around the late 90s.
Exactly. But Operation Trident, around the same time that we were, Black people also being stigmatized for being responsible for the influx of firearms into urban and working class communities, when really they would have to get them from somewhere because no one had to get them in Africa.
Exactly. And, but the when I was growing up listening to hip hop, a song like Fuck the Police by NWA, when I heard that, like, that sounds like Irish traditional folk music. But we had the equivalent of, so that, like I said, in the 1920s, there was a British soldiers in Ireland, and they were known as the Black and Tans, because their uniform was, they had black pants and tan tops. And these were particularly violent British soldiers who were brought in by Winston Churchill specifically to attack the civilian population. We view them as terrorists in Ireland. And there's an Irish traditional song called Come Out You Black and Tans, Come Out and Fight Me Like a Man. And this is basically Fuck the Police. It's the exact same thing. Amazing. So when I was listening to like NWA, I was going, this is the same. This is just Irish traditional music, but told from a completely different perspective. But what aligns the two things is the anti-colonialism. It's speaking to power. And then also what hip hop did for me was, like, nowadays when you think of, we'll say, the Black Lives Matter movement, and we're confronted with the visual spectacle of people having camera phones and recording police brutality. So now it's there on our screens to see. This wasn't really the case when I was a kid growing up. You might get a little snippet of Rodney King on TV. That was it.
I'm trying to think of other examples of violence that made the name mainstream.
Rodney King.
It was only Rodney King, and it was only because there was a camera there.
Yeah.
There was a camera there. But I was listening to Ice-T. I was listening to Ice Cube. So it didn't matter what the news wanted to tell me about Rodney King. It didn't matter that the news had a narrative of trying to suggest that Rodney King was a criminal, or suggesting that the police were right to beat him, because I'm listening to Ice-T, I'm listening to Ice Cube, who are speaking about it from what they're seeing in their communities. I'm listening to Public Enemy. So that allowed me an alternative narrative that went past what the media was saying. So I'm going, hold on a second, this police brutality is real, and it's way bigger than I'm seeing as a little kid on TV.
Absolutely.
Because Ice-T is telling the truth, and so is Chuck D. And so
I'm glad you said that, because that would be one of the ways I could most succinctly answer is, like Chuck D said, is that hip-hop is Black America CNN.
And
that's a really good reference point there as well, man. So that's what music means. It's the language of humanity, I think. It's the only real true way we can honestly chronicle our experience as human beings in a way that is perceivable to other humans. Like, we can write history books, but they're always going to have the bias of the victors in skirmishes and battles. But I think music, even particularly because, like, when we talk about vibrations and vibes, like in reggae music, for example, that pertains directly to like the vibration of molecules and cells, and like you know, listening to music at 528 megahertz, like there are all these things that vibrate, and you know, low frequency, high vibration music is a part of the human spiritual development, as opposed to high frequency and low vibration sounds like sirens and klaxons and alerts, which actually lower human vibration. So for me, music means anything, everything. I think music is, it's almost like the, what's the word? Like a metronome for the way our cells vibrate.
Yeah,
it's,
metronome for the soul.
Yeah, a metronome for the soul, I'd say.
And it's interesting what you're saying there, Dane, as well, because we in Western society, we tend not to credit music with that depth. Mm. In Western society, we tend to just think of music as entertainment.
Mm. Yeah.
But if you look at certain indigenous communities, like a lot of indigenous communities in South America that use like ayahuasca. Mm. So they will use ayahuasca as, we'd call it a psychedelic drug. It's not, it's a spiritual experience. But if you look at how the ayahuasca is consumed in the West, we would think, oh, it's this thing you drink and you get fucked up. And it's like, no. In South America, it's a thing that's drank. There's a day-long ritual around it. And very importantly is the music that's being played while the person consumes the ayahuasca. So they have a relationship between the rhythms, the melodies, the vibrations, and then also how this relates to the spiritual experience of taking this ayahuasca. And we in the West, we don't get that. We want to medicalize it. We want to figure out, how do you get ayahuasca and put it into a pill?
Yeah, that's the only thing with the West, is that it's we take this phenomenon like arts and culture, and every time it passes through the mill of commodification or capitalist commodification, then its significance is always reduced. In the same way that, like, you know, religion historically being a factor of people being able to, I guess, rationalize their own personal relationship with their own spirituality, or understanding that there is more to the corporeal and our consciousness, and working out how that links to, you know, other metaphysical phenomena, is what religion, how it's supposed to work, or our way of understanding or appreciating the fact that we know there's more to ourselves than just ourselves.
Yeah.
And obviously that being run through the, you know, the middle of capitalism and commodification means that now you have these compartmentalized ideas that revolve around institutionalized religion and this idea that for, and then by the same token of being capitalistic, it's this zero sum game where it's like, well, because we follow this doctrine, we're right. And thus anyone who doesn't must be wrong.
Yeah.
Which is not how it should work. Like if every religion's is characterized by the fact that they believe in an omniscient, omnipotent being, then why would you even have to vocalize your disagreement with other religions? Because you would know the omniscient creator of your own belief system will understand what's going to happen in the long run anyway. There will be a plan.
Yeah.
And they would, and also would understand the thoughts and minds and souls of, you know, people that don't follow the same doctrine as you. And there should be a plan that's greater than that, in the same way that, like, why would you ever worry about the manner in which anyone's born so far as a point of sexual orientation or beliefs? Because you know, they're all going to return to the creator who would have had a divine design in the first place.
What an amazing question. I'm not sure we can even end it there. We can keep going, but like we the format of the show dictates we move on to another question.
Okay.
But with that is listeners, what a great, such a simple question, right? Amazing, like, so simple a question, and yet it generated a multitude of thoughts there. A great shout.
Well, it predates human speech when you think about it, right? People would have played drums to communicate and you know, slap fires and stuff like that as well. So,
hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
My question this week is going to sidestep.
Go on.
The music. And it's kind of to both of you guys, but Blind Boy, you know, I've listened to your show, listened to your podcast, really enjoy it. I enjoyed one episode particularly because it featured a guest that I don't think is very easy to find as a guest. And so my simple question to you is this: how important is Adam Curtis, the documentary filmmaker? We've brought him up a couple of times on this show. Mm-hmm. He hasn't come on the show yet because he's a fucker to get hold of.
Howard, and we know he's doing great works.
He's doing great works.
But we're not going to go in something crazy
just,
right now.
Just, but you know, like I think he's a very interesting character. He definitely fucks a lot of people off. Some people absolutely love him. You spent some time with him, Blind Boy.
Yeah,
and I know Dane has plenty of thoughts about him. How important is Adam Curtis?
Well, to me personally, I used to have a musical act called The Rubber Bandits. And we used to do like comedy music. We do the odd gig in London, and Adam Curtis became like a fan, and he used to come to some of our gigs.
Oh, man.
I know.
That's amazing.
I know.
Fuck me.
He used to come to Soho Theatre.
That's so cool.
I didn't know who he was. And I was having pints with him, and I was just like, oh, it's this lovely, friendly English lad called Adam. And then my producer at the time says, you need to check out his documentaries. He's not just some friendly English lad. And then I looked at Adam Curtis's documentaries, and it changed. It just changed how I thought about documentaries. It changed about how I thought about making content. My own podcast is very much indebted to being a fan of Adam Curtis's work. What Adam Curtis does is, he brings the thinking of a writer and an artist to journalism and documentary. Mm-hmm. He uses storytelling. I won't say he embellishes the truth. He doesn't embellish the truth, but he does construct a narrative that follows the beats of fiction.
Yes, yeah, that's a really good way of putting it, yeah.
Create a documentary that impacts you so much more than a straight, cold documentary. Adam Curtis has a way of making a documentary that hits you in the heart the way that a piece of art does.
He almost presents truth in a way with the same elaborate meticulousness that you would produce the lies and fiction and the pageantry you see in fiction, like you said all the time. It's like, instead of being like, here's the hard facts followed by statistics and graphical or statistical representation, he talks in all the elements of just the inception of a topic or a theme that he's discussing, and right from the beginning of it, how it forms.
It's a really good observation then, because the thing about it to me, when I watch his work, is I feel he is like, you know, there's this spectrum, and, you know, at one point the two ends of the spectrum meet each other. So I think actually, you know, when I look at, I saw the front page of The Sun the other day when I was walking past the shop, and I saw that they were complaining about the fact that the Brit Awards are no longer going to have gender-based awards. It's going to be just artists. And the front page was like, look what they've done now, the fucking lunatics. And I was like, that's just crazy. And I was thinking, God. But for the agenda that they set, it's totally logical. Like, it's totally logical. And so at some point...
I mean, if we're very honest with ourselves as human beings, it's massively overdue. And really, the discussion about even separating artistic achievement along the lines of gender, really and truly...
Completely.
Considering creativity has its origins in the feminine hemisphere of the brain.
There's no argument for me about that. It's more that I just thought The Sun was like... I was looking at it going, that sounds about right for The Sun. So I kind of think when I can reflect on Adam Curtis's work, you know, Adam Curtis could kind of go into, like, I don't know, the rise of Oasis and pull out strands of it that fit the narrative of his perspective on the world, which I would say I concur with elements of what he comes up with. Obviously, as you say, he's kind of presenting a version of history, isn't he?
Yeah.
That isn't everything, because he couldn't possibly do that, right, Blind Boy? It's like...
But also what... So I was never very good at school. I didn't fit very well into the system of school and how... things like history, mathematics, how academic things were taught,
and how compartmentalized, as if they're all separate doctrines. It's like separating maths and science by chemistry and biology and physics. It's like, how can you separate these two things?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was made to feel kind of dumb because I failed in school. And what Adam Curtis's work did is he would take subjects that I had been led to believe this is for smart people. But now all of a sudden I'm understanding it, because Adam Curtis is speaking in a language that I understand, and that's the language of art and creativity. Mm. So now subjects that I felt were inaccessible to me because the school system said this is for smart people and you're a failure, now I'm understanding and engaging with things I didn't feel that I had permission to engage with, because Adam Curtis is just telling it in an interesting way. And it always reminded me of, no matter how shittily I got on in school, there was always one good teacher. And this teacher had a passion for the subject they were speaking about, and had a way to communicate the academic doctrine using storytelling so that everybody understood the subject that was being spoken about. And then other teachers didn't. They just went by the book. And if you didn't catch up, you were stupid. Mm-hmm. And Adam Curtis made things accessible to me that I was led to believe were not for me because I was stupid.
Yeah, that's such an interesting way of looking at it. And I think what he kind of does as well is by putting the art first, right? That's the kind of thing. It's like when you watch the history of documentaries, putting the art first often doesn't generate a huge following. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen Pervert's Guide to Ideology.
By Slavoj Žižek.
Yeah, which is...
I can't pronounce his name, but yeah.
He did a pretty good job there. But, but you know, that guy's work, I'd recommend listeners, if you like Adam Curtis, or you go and it's check
amazing,
Adam Curtis, you go and check that guy. But maybe you'd agree with me, Blind Boy, probably a tougher... it's quite a tough watch.
A lot tougher.
Yeah.
He does a brilliant analysis of the film They Live by... what's his name? John what?
John Waters? John Carpenter.
Yeah. John Carpenter.
Yeah.
So... Like, so Slavoj Žižek,
that's a great film. That's
an amazing film. But yeah. Zizek, in this documentary, The Pervert's Guide to Ideology, he takes this John Carpenter film and says, this isn't just an entertaining film. This is how it exactly deconstructs the messages behind capitalism. Mm. And he does it brilliantly. And that then led to me to have a deeper understanding of the work of John Carpenter.
I feel like the Zizek's work is like almost like kind of a Velvet Underground spin-off band that someone, whereas like for me, Adam Curtis is like Radiohead, like the biggest version of the thing that could ever be created. And listen, man, you're in that history now. Like what you did in Undestroys the World, I know you had, you know, you weren't 100% completely happy with the final point. I know you had some...
I was happy with it. It's just that when... So Blind Boy Undestroys the World was... It's a series of documentaries I made about capitalism, about the world today. Like, it was BBC. I loved making it. It was such a wonderful opportunity. But when you make... Like, here's the other thing about Adam Curtis. Adam Curtis is a rare artist, very rare, in that when he wants to make something for the BBC, they just say to him, go do it. We're going to stay out of it. And Curtis says, you better fucking stay out of it. I'm making what I want to make. And he comes back with a fucking 3-hour or a 7-hour documentary that goes on the player. So he has quite a lot of freedom that other documentary makers don't make. And he's aware of this. And he spoke about it on my podcast. But yeah, I made these documentaries for the BBC.
I think they're great, by the way.
Thank you very much. Really, and I was really very good. Happy with them. But at the same time, and this isn't necessarily a critique, but when you go to the BBC, they're investing money in this documentary and they expect a return. Mm-hmm. And they expect, you have to compromise creatively at points so that you can make a product for a TV channel that can market it. So that's like in my own podcast, that's completely free. I can do an entire hour about a potato if I want, and no one's there to tell me, can you bring Brian McFadden in and make it like a dancing program? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Curtis represents a freedom as well that doesn't really exist anymore. He'd be like the Beatles in 1967, where the Beatles are like, we're not doing gigs anymore and we're just going to make a weird album, or Frank Zappa or Funkadelic. We're going to do something really crazy and weird and people are going to buy it. Adam Curtis is the last of that.
Oh man, you've hit the nail on the head there, because it's making TV, as all three of us will testify, is a complicated team game.
But at the same time, I genuinely, the way I see Adam Curtis is that one day when our civilization is over, when alien archaeologists try to work out how the fuck we fucked up, they'll look at an Adam Curtis documentary. He's almost like, you know, I just think in the same way that like the aesthetic of modern life is almost satirized and subverted by, you know, people like Stanley Kubrick. Mm-hmm. I think Adam Curtis kind of applies that kind of same sensibility, as you said, the creativity of the shows, and almost makes everything appear quite kitchen twee from a distance. And then you almost kind of like watching pan around the earth or zoom in. And then it's almost to like lifting a rock to see the insects beneath the structures that we are kind of base our reality and our.
And the thing that you occasionally hear, Dane, is people go like, oh yeah, but he's left loads out. And he's like, well, how do you think he's supposed to fit it all fucking in? Like, how's he ever going to fit everything that is right and wrong with the world?
That's the thing too, Howard. What I love about Adam Curtis's work is who he pisses off and why. And who he tends to piss off are people who want to gatekeep what they see as intelligent stuff. Mm. People who are like, you can't present this as entertainment. This is real serious academic shit. Mm. This is stuff that must exist in journals. This is stuff that people with PhDs and master's degrees speak about to other academics. And they get really annoyed that Adam Curtis introduces
the compartmentalization of knowledge. And that's the difference.
There you go, exactly.
The difference intellectuals and academics is that these academics pride themselves, and even to the point of deriving self-esteem, from being able to have a particular proficiency in one small element or compartmentalized element
and to exclude
of the knowledge and to exclude others. Yeah, and that's how they derive their self-esteem, which is why you have like, you know, historians like David Starkey, who may focus on a particular aspect of British imperialist history and celebrate this. And by that same token, he's able to politically identify with that narrative because it also benefits him. And it's just partially half of the story.
Isn't that why curing cancer is becoming increasingly slower? Because, well, not curing, helping cancer, because the different cancer charities don't share their information.
Yeah, that's a big problem. And if you trace that, what we're speaking about there, I did a podcast on it recently. You can trace it to the fucking Victorians, right? Mm. So during the Victorian period, do you know ferns, those plants, ferns?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They became really popular in the Victorian period. I'll tell you why it happened. Around 1830, when the Industrial Revolution led to cities like Bristol and London and Manchester, these huge industrial cities, pollution was so fucking bad in these cities that the new middle class who lived in townhouses, they couldn't grow houseplants. There was so much coal in the air, they couldn't grow fucking houseplants. Wow. So this person figured out, oh shit, if I get a little fern and put it in a jar, I can actually grow it in my house. So it led to what was called the Victorian fern craze, where people began to fetishize ferns, but it became a very female activity. So women in the Victorian period in England who would have been, they wouldn't have been allowed out without chaperones. This was a very, very misogynistic society. All of a sudden, women were allowed go into the woods to collect ferns, and it created a space for women to be able to be with each other without the gaze of men. It allowed, there was a lot of lesbians involved in this. Women were able to express sexuality that was outside of what was deemed to be acceptable in Victorian society. And then all of a sudden, women started to discover new ferns. They started to name new ferns. They started to create the science of botany. Wow. But then what happens around 1870, some men didn't like this. And then they gave botany a name. And they said, this is now a serious science for men and men only, and women aren't allowed in. And this is called botany, and it's really, really important. And all this work that women did in collecting and the taxonomy of ferns was just fucking ignored. And now it became a men-only science. And you see that across the board with multiple sciences and how it became academia, turned into academia, and then in the service of capitalism and the boundaries that denotes.
Yeah, what an amazing story! What amazing answer to these two questions so far are going to blow my mind. The amount we've managed to fit in this dialogue, right?
I know. I feel sorry for your fucking Howard because you're the one who has to time these questions.
This is all good. We've nailed it, and I'm going to hand it over to the brilliant Dane Baptiste to complete the trio of questions from today. We've had music and Adam Curtis. What you got up your sleeve, Dane?
I want to keep it relatively I hope it's relatively easy. Well, I took the time to rewatch the Blind Boy and Destroys the World documentary, which I did love. And
thank you.
I'd say that within the context of being aware of the inhibitions that would have been projected onto you by terrestrial TV channels. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I would like to think that I can and will show solidarity with your work and how progressive it is and humanitarian it is on another level as well. And I think what tends to happen is that within our industry, sometimes people might be reluctant to show solidarity with the themes you're discussing because of whatever short-term benefit they may be enjoying based on their status in the industry. That's not a condemnation, just an observation.
Yeah.
But I want to ask Blind Boy, really, that do you, obviously, being part of the Rubber Bandits and using shopping bags as masks, do you find that work you're doing to be progressive ideologically and also to empower people without voices, people who are suffering, and just to do your humanitarian work in general, do you think that's easy to do with a alter ego or an anonymous identity?
Great question.
So I wear a plastic bag in my head and I go by the name of Blind Boy, which obviously isn't my real name. It's a pen name. There's a couple of reasons I do this. Number one is to protect my mental health. I'm an artist. I love writing. I love making documentaries. I love making podcasts. I fucking love this. This gives me a sense of meaning. But I don't necessarily like being recognized or having any notoriety. My personality doesn't suit that. I have a history of agoraphobia, social anxiety, depression, panic attacks, which I manage really, really well. Mm. And I live my life free of these things. But I think if I was going into fucking Aldi or Lidl and people are recognizing me. I don't know what I have the personality that would be able to maintain my mental health under that. Mm-hmm. I think I might, my head might go up my arse very quickly and I might become quite arrogant. The pressure of being recognized is a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, Dane, you'll know this, man. People who you don't know will know who you are and go, Dane, what's up? I love what you're doing.
Yeah, and where I've grown up, it's like, I'd say a few times I've been quite paranoid or even may have appeared to be confrontational because I'm like, why is someone staring at me? And they're like, oh, I love you here. And you're like, oh, okay.
There you go.
Yeah, so I definitely relate to that. And even I probably felt myself developing some agoraphobia.
That's a lot.
Just before lockdown, yeah. It really is, especially if you're not used to it. And, you know, it's not something you, like I said, as an artist, your goal, I mean, my goal was to be able to do something I love and be able to just do that for a living and be able to have concepts become tangible phenomena in my life. That's like my goal as an artist, is to chronicle my humanity or my human experience in a way that's perceivable to other people. I didn't necessarily factor in what comes with that notoriety or that increase in profile. And so I am aware that it can be part and parcel, but like you said, it can be for your social anxiety, for agoraphobia, people you don't know approaching you can be really, nerve-wracking.
It's nerve-wracking, but I guarantee you, that you know people in the industry and their personalities are quite well suited to this.
Yes.
Like, definitely. I know lots of people and it's like, they fucking love getting recognized and this is who they are. And for them, brilliant. The job is perfect. Mm. For me, I just want to make fucking art and I don't want to be recognized as such. I want to go, this is my work life. This is my private life. So this works really well for me, even though I'm not particularly anonymous. Like, people can go online, they can find my real name. Like, I pay taxes, but the thing is, people engage with the spectacle. Yeah. It's like, I love The Simpsons, but when I see one of the actors of The Simpsons doing the voice, I'm not getting that starstruck feeling as if it was actually Bart Simpson. Something is off.
Yeah.
So people engage with the spectacle. So the other thing too, I in my podcast, at least once a month, I do a mental health podcast. Where, like, I used to study psychology, but before I became an entertainer, I was going to become a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. And I studied psychotherapy for like 3 years. I didn't get my qualification, but I did years of counseling. I did years of learning about psychology. So I speak about mental health, not only from a personal perspective, but how I apply psychology to help myself. And I get to be very honest when I do this. A huge part of speaking about your own emotions and speaking about mental health, you have to show people that you're comfortable being vulnerable. This means being okay with saying things like, sometimes I'm insecure. Sometimes I'm jealous of other people. Sometimes I feel weak. Sometimes I don't feel strong. To be this vulnerable, I'm able to do this on the space of my podcast. Mm-hmm. But if I didn't have that fucking bag on my head, I don't, like, when you open up like that and other people relate to it, it can open up something in them. And I don't think I'd have the emotional space for someone coming up to me in a pub and saying, that thing you said on your podcast about mental health made me think about my own life. And then I have someone sharing with me. Because I have pals who work in the entertainment industry and they speak about mental health. And one of the issues is, when you live in a country like Ireland that doesn't have adequate mental health services, mm-hmm. when someone in the public eye speaks about depression, speaks about suicide, speaks about self-harm, people will come up to you in public and they will disclose. And when someone does that, you need to be fully emotionally present for that person.
Well, and who's to say that that person should in any way be qualified to be in that conversation, you know?
But if you're in a fucking pub and you're on your fourth pint and three people come up to you to speak about their depression, you might end up saying something harmful. You might end up, someone might come up and say, I need to speak to you about your depression. I saw what you said on television. And you don't have the time or the emotional space at that moment and you're turning them away. Because I have a plastic bag on my head, that's not part of my life. Yeah. So I can share and I can speak about mental health as much as possible while maintaining my own emotional boundaries. Mm-hmm. And that really, really helps me.
Yeah. I think it's an amazing service that you do with that monthly episode. And I think by doing that, you're doing your bit, you know, that's
the shit that helps me sleep at night.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's like, you know, you kind of go, what the fuck am I doing? I'm making a few people laugh. What am I fucking doing? But then when I think, okay, I'm sharing some of my own vulnerability and my mental health journey, and then this might help other people, then that just gives me a sense of purpose and meaning that helps me to sleep at night, if you get me.
No, definitely. I think for most artists, that is part of the endeavor. It's you know, mm-hmm. almost leading by example by being able to chronicle and articulate your struggles. I think everyone benefits from that. And it goes back to the initial question about what music means to you. It means that much. It means that somebody is committing a part of their psyche to something tangible that initially comes from longitudinal waves because it's compression of air. But what happens mm-hmm. is in the world we live in is that now, because of technology, we can now record said narrative and that becomes transverse waves. And as you know, those, even though they may weaken or dissipate, they don't disappear from existence, like it's energy. So transverse waves never disappear. So it means if you commit something, a piece of art or a song is committed to wax and that's played and broadcast, mm-hmm. that continues to beam into space. So however the universe continues to expand or however it changes, however million years we are away from our evolution and Homo sapien becomes a memory in terms of the journey of our the carbon-based life forms that occupy this planet, there is a tangible record of that existence that is still out there. And that means that, when we talk about religious institutions as we did before, well, one of the things I think most human beings, through their recognition of the metaphysical and something being more to them than just their physical bodies, whether it's a consciousness or a soul, well, until the evidence is conclusive, creativity and art is the only way we have to kind of, outside of procreating, a way of ensuring our immortality, or that we will create something that will outlive our physical selves.
Yeah. And I think when you say that, man, like, it makes me think about how there's been this thing, let's call it for the last decade, it's less potentially, but where people are going, oh, we're in this mental health crisis, and, you know, kind of, oh, we're all becoming more aware about our mental health. And to me, I'm not being dismissive in any way, I think there's always been a mental health crisis. I think that everyone has
not even a crisis, Howard. Everyone has a mental health problem. Everyone has a complex, and your complex should have always taken the same level of prescience as your physical being.
And like, why didn't it?
Right, exactly. We could always identify physical defects. We could identify whether it's disability or even if it's like any kind of shortcoming due to whether it's substance, I'm not saying substance abuse or like misuse of substances, but if someone's malnourished or if someone's dehydrated, then we've always been able to identify and diagnose and treat that accordingly. The psychological equivalent of dehydration or the psychological equivalent of malnutrition isn't something we, again, outside of clandestine in the elite circles of psychologists or psychiatrists.
It's like you got that friend. Have you got that friend that you reckon like 10, 20 years ago, you would have looked at their issues they have and gone, oh, he just needs to fucking sort himself out and stop drinking. Do you know what I mean? Or
we used to use phrases like, I don't know if this existed in Britain, but in Ireland, we used to say the words like nervous breakdown or that person's nerves are at them. Now, we don't say that anymore. The word nervous breakdown means nothing. It was a catch-all term for several different... Yeah. Now we have more language. Now, depression, anxiety, ADHD, this person is neurodivergent. We have a much greater language. But by exposing this language, and it opens up parts of ourselves, and now people are going, I have a language for how I feel now and I need help, but the infrastructure hasn't caught up.
No, well, it's the same as racism. It's like racism being this thing that we've suddenly gone...
Well, they're both linked. I think if we were to really assess the psychological disposition of most racists or people that held... Well, racists and people that hold prejudiced views are two separate things, Howard, first of all.
Yeah.
Because I would argue there may be many people that are racist in terms of the fact that they have created, perpetuate and empower systems or infrastructures which oppress minority groups. But they may not do that because they don't like black people. I would argue that some racists, for example, the racists that have funded, cyber attacks and divisions online between people along social media, don't necessarily do that because they hate black or brown people. They do that because they like, if people continue to argue amongst themselves, they'll forget that in 2008, we destroyed their entire economy. And through austerity measures, we're going to bring them back to the dark ages in terms of the inequality of resource allocation. But they don't necessarily hate black people, but they realize that if people realize that black people are humans, then they will realize that the exploitation of resources in somewhere like the Congo for coltan, for technology, will mean a massive loss in profits for them. So it's just in the same way that, like, I don't think that people in power in the US government necessarily hate Muslims. It's just that let's find a generic way of grouping the people from the region of what we define as the Middle East in order to dehumanize them to facilitate our exploitation of oil reserves. Let's just call them Muslims, knowing full well that there's Zoroastrians and there's over 100,000 Christians in the same region of Iraq that we're attacking. But it's just a way of generalizing and appealing to... And the correct way of, and what they're actually using is the manipulation of mental health people by feeding into their fear or people's feelings of adequacy. It's not all about race. So even, I've said it before in a podcast before, I think the whole thing with mental health and is more about, we don't have the psychological equivalent of gyms. Gyms have now become commercialized. That they're always available to people if they need to address any physical defaults or physical inadequacies they may have or deficiencies they may perceive. But what we don't have is the psychological equivalent of that, where you can walk in and be like, I just need an hour of therapy, or I need an hour of cognitive therapy to speak to somebody. I just need an hour with, you know, I just need an hour to kind of like describe my anxiety. I need an hour so I can just have a moment of explosive anger in order for me to rationalize some trauma I suffered when I was younger. Or I need a space where, you know, like in gyms, they have like spin class and they have yoga. I need a space where I can recreate a example of trauma, so, but it changes, so I'm in control of the situation in order for me to rationalize the trauma that I suffered as a child. Because, you know, that happens with a lot of people sexually. Like, people talk about like fetish and people talk about kink, but a lot of the time, sometimes people experience sexual trauma and try to recreate that same paradigm where they're in control so they can process their trauma a lot better. It's like, and you know, Howard, it's like, even if we talk about, because that in itself will link to discussions about, you know, gender dysmorphia that arises from sexual trauma. And then that in turn would lead to a longer discussion about us having a better understanding of the complex behind gender reassignment, rather than trying to have some kind of unified theory as to why people may change their gender. So I think, I understand where you're coming from, Blind Boy, because that's a lot to do. And sometimes when you're able to just provide, in a way, like a straw man in the form of Blind Boy, that's something that people are able to project onto, and you still get to be your own individual while you continue to have that journey of dynamically processing your own human conflicts.
Just to make a point on what you said there about, you know, we don't have these the equivalent of gyms for mental health, and to take back to, there's an Adam Curtis documentary called Century of the Self. And it could be argued that in our current model of capitalist society, we don't have, capitalism can't exist when a population has emotional literacy and is mentally healthy. If you look at the Adam Curtis episode, Century of the Self, where he went into how the modern consumerism was invented by Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays. So in the 1920s, Edward Bernays looked at his uncle's, Sigmund Freud's book and said, this unconscious business, I bet you I can use this to sell people shit they don't need. So in our society today, when you buy soap, for instance, right now, soap, all soap does is that it gets you clean and it might make you smell nicer. That's all soap does. But if you look at how soap is advertised, they're not selling you something that gets you clean and makes you smell nice. They're selling you a better version of yourself. So all products today, when we consume, we're not buying what we need. We're trying to purchase a better version of ourselves. And a person who has emotional literacy and is who is comfortable with who they are and is happy, they're not going to think that soap is going to make them a better person. So capitalism exists only within a society that is traumatized and mentally damaged. And only then can we continually sell people things they don't need.
Yeah. To suggest that we have covered a lot of ground in today's episode, Dane, that's like a killer episode. That's an amazing episode.
It is, but I'd say as well, first of all, Blind Boy, thank you so much, bro. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Liz.
But Howard, you know what? For me, I don't find it particularly, it's not like a difficult intellectual endeavor, because when you're speaking to somebody who's accepted the truths within themselves, like Blind Boy said, it's having the awareness to refer back to oneself and be like, I experienced bouts of inadequacy. I experienced bouts of jealousy. I experienced bouts of vulnerability. Opening your mind up to those truths means that any other stream of consciousness or exchange with other people can happen so much easier, because you haven't created these psychological walls out of fear that these deep, dark recesses of your mind will be discovered by somebody else.
Yeah. You're not defensive.
Yeah, you're not defensive. You're
I've looked at my own. I've looked at the pain within me. Mm. I've stared at it. I'm comfortable with it. Therefore, I can share it and speak about it because I'm not hiding from it.
Yeah, exactly.
When you're hiding from your insecurity, hiding from your the things in yourself that you don't like, you tend to defend them, and you defend them by pushing people away.
Precisely. And I've been told I'm self-critical sometimes, but it is actually just a pathological practice of maybe examining the most extreme extreme aspects of negative self-image I may have for one of two reasons. I think it's a really good way of teaching myself self-discipline through empathy and being like, you know how this shit makes you feel. So be mindful of flippant comments you may make that make other people feel this way as well. And also it's kind of like, you know, by understanding that this is within me, it's almost like by the merit of it being within yourself, then other people must feel this way as well. And so even on from a negative perspective, there's going to be this mutuality with other human beings. So no, I totally dig it, man. And I respect it, man. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast and imparting that stream of consciousness on us, man.
There's going to have to be a part two next year.
Jesus, I'd love to come back on. And
yeah, it'd be a pleasure.
Just, I've nothing really to plug. I've got a podcast called The Blind Boy Podcast. Give it a listen if you want to. Don't if you don't want to.
It's great. Go and listen to it, guys.
I recommend it, guys. And if you haven't, also do check out Adam Curtis's work as well. But yeah,
and November Rain.
And November Rain.
And
Hazard by Richard Marx and Frankie by Rod Stewart, man. Just expand your mind and just remember music is to be listened to, not just heard. So yeah, enjoy.
Thanks
it, man.
Again, Blind
Thanks again
Boy.
Blind Boy, appreciate it, man.
Thanks, lads.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at danebaptweets or Instagram at danesnaptiste. Our guest was Blind Boy. You can follow Blind Boy on Instagram and Twitter at Blind Boy Boat Club. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at the Howard Cohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at We Are Audio Culture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks for listening, guys, and remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.